Hello and welcome to another episode of Risky Business. I'm Tame Warner-Beely.
And I'm Darian McBain. And today we're going to touch on a topic that we've touched on previously, which is the carbon markets, because they're back in the media yet again.
Yeah, last time we talked about it because The Guardian ran an article about how verification of some forest projects and Verra in itself were being called into question as to the validity of what's going on. And this time we have a whole new bunch of complaints coming up in the media, don't we?
So one of the most controversial things that's happened recently was the SBTI, the Science-Based Targets Initiative Board, put out a statement without necessarily consulting with their staff to say, in summary terms, that Scope 3 emissions can be considered for carbon offsets. And that sparked a huge amount of controversy. And Tamil, you've been seeing some other things come up in the media since then.
We saw the FT running an article about how Shell was, according to them, in some way not playing particularly fair with the way they were using carbon offsets. We've also seen the BBC on Panorama doing an expose, which generated a little bit of controversy about how some other companies were presenting their work in this field. So there's a lot of controversy going on, a lot of talk. And in the meantime, in the past year, as you know, because of that original Guardian article, the whole offset market has taken a bit of a tanking. And it's not necessarily doing particularly well. So the whole media image, the whole perception and the trust in this whole process seems to be into question.
And I think that trust is what I really wanted to talk about today, because how can you have trust in a market which is varying so much? And I spoke to someone who works in this field last night, and I was asking about how quickly the carbon market will develop. And she actually said that she thinks it will develop as fast as you can develop trust, which I thought was a really interesting perspective to really catch for this episode.
All right, let's bring in Mikael Larsen, well known in this part of the world, and in fact all over the world, as a real mentor and expert in the all things sustainability. Mikael used to be the CSO at DBS, which is Singapore's largest bank, now the CEO of CIX, which is the Singapore Carbon Exchange, which has been going for how long now?
About 2 years.
Singapore leading the way in many ways in this conversation. So that'd be an interesting angle to pick up on. But let's just step back and look at the broader landscape here, Mikael. As Darian said, the Science-Based Targets Initiative, since it started, 2021, it set this idea that carbon trading and carbon credits should be a minor part of a corporation's offset mechanisms, because they wanted the emphasis to be on actual carbon reduction, not on offsetting. Now they've decided that they're going to change that completely, and it's caused a furore. Give us your initial thoughts on what's happening here.
Sure, very happy to do those. Thank you for having me today. So I think we have to start off by giving some thoughts to what trust really means in this type of market, because there's many elements that requires trust. In climate impact, we talk about four areas. It's trust in the quality of the actual carbon credits. And that's what you talked about before. The Panorama program was around that. And some of the earlier controversies around Verra was around that. Then there is the trust in the use of it. And a lot of the latest controversy has been around that. If you're using carbon credits, are you therefore displacing other actions that you should be taking? So that's kind of how you're using the product itself. Then there's a trust element around the price. I don't know if you know, but the prices vary dramatically in this market. And sometimes for good reasons, sometimes because the market is opaque. They can be at $1, they can be at $1,000. Mm. We rarely see that level. And then, of course, there's been this notion of cowboys. So there's also the trust in the execution.
But this is why the SBTI angle is so important, because they are the body that is supposed to verify and give that level of trust to this mechanism, right?
Well, to the second pillar, which is the trust in the use of it. And to say that they have completely deviated from the original goal, I think may not be entirely accurate. They still hold that at a net zero, whenever we get to that, you can only use carbon credits for 10%, and it has to be a certain type of carbon credit. But what I think, and I support that, they realized is we don't have the luxury of time to wait until that point in time. And at this point in time, there's plenty of good reasons for why you should try and bring in carbon credits as a pathway, on your pathway to net zero. And let me try and give you some of the facts. You have to first remember what we're trying to address here. We're trying to address scope three. So scope three, for those who are not so familiar with this, is essentially outside your own value. It's within your value chain, but it's outside your direct control.
Yeah, very hard to actually make a difference in scope three.
And we see that concretely everywhere now, where companies are getting worried. We still have 81% of companies who have not set targets. And why have they not set targets? I'd argue that part of that is because they simply don't know how to get there, and if you're in a hard-to-abate sector, and are you then better off trying to take actions, including use of carbon credits, or are you better off just saying, no, it's just too hard, I won't do it? And the second bit is, and this is privately controversial, scope three, as we all know, is someone else's scope one and two. So in theory, if everybody that got scope one and two right, we didn't need to solve scope three. I'm glad that we have a scope three because we know not everybody will get there. But we're talking about something where a company have two choices. They either address it or they don't. So when would it be valid for a company to use carbon credit? It would be if we could find some evidence that it doesn't displace other actions. And I'll give you a couple of facts.
Sorry, just to just reiterate that. When would it make sense is if it doesn't displace other activity.
And the other activities is decarbonizing as best you can.
Because that's always been the controversy, hasn't it? The fact that people are saying...
It's around that scope one and two. So what the company is doing itself and not making sure that they are still decarbonizing and on that pathway rather than just paying money to somebody else to do the work for them, which isn't really the equivalent.
Correct. But we also have to remember that, and if you you take the example of Unilever, I think who has just walked back some of their commitments. Why are they doing it? Because I think there was a tendency for a lot of companies who make grandiose, and I'm not using Unilever here, it's just an example, but grand, you know, statements around them getting to net zero very quickly, and then realizing this is hard work, hard to abate sectors. They're either not technically feasible or economically viable. And you got to ask yourself, when is something economically viable? But there are these sectors, and I know them really well, where it's simply not possible to get there. So back to my point, if you don't displace your best actions you could do yourself in scope 1, 2, and 3, carbon credit, with all the controversies there is around, it's got to be better than doing nothing. We're protecting forests. We're allowing new technology to come to market faster. Let me give you a couple of statements on around that. In a survey done by We Mean Business, 71% said that carbon credits made it more likely for them to be able to take decarbonization actions than they otherwise would have. In other words, they were willing to make targets because they know they have a mechanism. Let me give you a couple of more. 81% of companies in another study done by Ecosystem Marketplace and backed up by Trove and a rating company called Silvera suggested that companies who use carbon credit is 1.8 times more likely to also decarbonize themselves. In other words, there's a positive correlation. And it does make some sense, right? Because why would I go and pay for these carbon credits if I could just say, look, I'm not doing anything right now, right? So this notion of this being a displacement of actual taking actions, I think has continuously been being shown not to be right. And then there's a last study that I thought was quite interesting recently that actually said that a majority of companies asked if they had a budget for carbon credits and they didn't use it because it was being discredited in the market, that money would not have gone to anything else. It'll just go into the normal BAU product. So if you think about that, it doesn't mean that everything is rosy, but I think there's a very solid case for saying in scope three, to a certain extent, and using the right types of credits that are of high quality, we can talk about what that means, there is really a use case for this. And that's what the SBTI recognized. But I want to reemphasize again, they're not saying just use that all the way through, or when you get to net zero, you just claim it. For the same reason that the EU has come out and says, you know, be very careful by calling something carbon neutral, because it isn't carbon neutral. But you can safely say that because we are not neutral, we've taken these compensation actions and we've helped some people. We help, you know, spirits acknowledge you come to the world, and we're proud of it.
So I think you've brought up some really good reasons of why carbon credits have a valuable place in our market. But why do we continue to hear these questions about integrity? You know, why do we have an integrity council for the voluntary carbon market? And why does that continuously come up?
I think that's good. So what we just addressed right now was my second pillar, this use of the product, right? And there we have SBTI being worried of these displacements action. We have another body called Voluntary Carbon Market Initiative, a bit of a mouthful, we call them VCMI. What you're now asking about is moving back to where the controversy started, which was the integrity of the credits themselves, right? And for that part of it, I'll give you my honest, unfiltered answer, and then we can talk about it. First of all, the studies that were behind some of these, let's not go deeply into them, but there was a study behind all, it was called West et al., has been proven to be scientifically not 100% robust. But it's much easier to forget that part, the rebuttal, than it is. The study itself got a lot more attention than the rebuttal did. But that doesn't mean that there aren't some bad projects out there. There certainly is. And we're doing a lot of things to change that. But before I get there, if you then talk about where I think people misunderstand, we can talk about many different types of carbon credits, but we tend to, it's easier to work with preservation of nature because it's like something we all understand. So when you look at those, I don't know if you know, but to do a normal project takes about 2 years of preparation works and about $1 million just to do a small project. 700 people is involved in such a project. In one of those things that are being criticized by the articles that you called up, one person has misconducted, right? And as a result, the whole project was discredited. If you think about this time more, if you were to buy your shoes from a company that was made by a group of 700 people, and one of those people did something poor, you know, and actions were taken, would you stop buying your shoes from there? No, you'd recognize that if there's good governance and people get kicked out, that is exactly how it should be. These things are massively more complicated. That doesn't mean we shouldn't ask for high quality, but I think the bar has been set because people think of them as a commodity.
Well, I mean, you're implying that this is not quite as big a problem as some people.
No, I'm saying that we're holding the bar of perfection far too high compared to where we did somebody else.
Okay, I mean, I don't know what the empirical data is surrounding that, and how does one judge that? All I can say is that the staff of SBTI, in the comments that they came out with, actually began questioning some of this themselves. I mean, Reuters wrote this report only recently saying they had got a document that came out of those conversations, and it says that higher quality empirical and observational evidence suggests that some or most emission reduction credits are ineffective in delivering emission reductions.
And that goes back to that study that I just talked about. So that was 73% in that study, and that was heavily rebutted ever since that. But I think we have to come back to the fundamentals of this. When something is being discredited of not being effective, right? And I dispute, first of all, some of those things, but even if I took and agreed with it, again, the logic for what I presented those facts to you before is that if something is not effective, it simply means that it is less effective, right? Because we're getting into the technicalities of you had a baseline and you said, compared to what would have happened with deforestation, I will reduce it by this much. And you generate the carbon credits as a result of it. My question to you is that if it's these things that I just pointed to are true and people would not have otherwise used that money for something else, even if they were only 80% effective, are we better off protecting 80% or 100%? We're still better off. Again, I don't want to use this as an excuse for not asking for more, but let me point to another fact. The fact is right now that with carbon credits being at $1, we are somewhere between 4 to 8 times below the marginal cost of bringing them to life. So how can we ask 700 people to come together, a group of people in Africa, Indonesia, all these places, to stop doing what they normally would have done? And then sometimes the money stops coming. How can we do that? Right? We have to stick to the course of this. But let's move on. So ICVCM that you referred to is an attempt to set the bar anew, set it again, right? And I think that's a good thing, and we needed to reinstall trust. At the same time, if you think about it, we have the new methodologies coming in from, for example, VERA, to try and reinsert trust, recognizing that it has been problems in the past. And I'm not blind to some of those problems. My key point being that we're setting the bar too high for these types of projects. But nevertheless, we got ICVCM, we got new methodologies, and then we got people like ourselves without promoting my company, which have taken the active stand that if we can't bring trust into the product, as I said, the use of the product, the price of the product, and the execution of the product, then we're all going to be failing once again. Mm. But we are still dealing with a relatively nascent market, right?
Well, maybe if we could go to your organization. So CIX, sure. Carbon Impact X, I mean, you said you've been at the CEO for around 2 years now. When I came to Singapore, you were just starting in that role.
Yeah.
I mean, tell us a little bit about that journey. It was the first carbon market exchange in the region, wasn't it? And how has it gone? Like, have you had the impact perhaps that you were expecting that you would have? And what were some of the challenges and real impacts that you've seen?
No, thank you kindly for saying that. So we got established as a private-public partnership together with Singapore here. And we're not the only one in the exchange, and there were people before us. But we were trying to do things differently. And because we were born the way we did with the shareholders we were did, and with the government's, not support, well, we did get support, but not the financial support, just with the kind of backing, then we could not have done anything but having to focus on quality and trust. Now, that sounds great, but obviously that such a promise comes with a cost as well, because there are certain projects I can't sell. And you have to have your own supply team, you have to have your own quality team, assessment team. And in many respects, life could have been easier if I just say, caveat emptor, I sell anything, is between willing buyer, willing seller, they can just go and buy anything. And most other people would do that.
When you say you can't sell because you don't have a buyer or because they don't meet the integrity standards that
of my own. We've made a conscious choice to do our very best to only sell things that we understand and that we stand for. Now, that doesn't make us a rating agency. That doesn't make us a standard setter. But we think because of the corporates we serve, that if we don't deliver on those 4 trust promises, chances are we're no better than anybody else. Now, as I said, that comes with a cost, right? Because you're choosing to have, you know, limit your own supply and therefore also your own buyers, right? Because some people just want the cheap stuff and I won't sell it. But that was kind of how we were born. Does that mean that I create more impact? Well, if I took my own argument from before, you could say even a project that does do a little bit of good is better. I think we've got to aim higher than that. And therefore, we have set the bar at a certain level and thinking about certain things that we do no harm for the project. And that's what we are willing to do. But we do it for another reason as well. We don't just do it so that we can say this is quality and we know our stuff. It's also because there is no perfection. So it's back to your point before, Taimur. There's very, very, unless you're willing to pay $1,000 for a ton of carbon, which very few people are, and even they are not perfect, there is no AAA project out there. As I said, that
right.
There are actually, but they're tiny, 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 tiny volumes. So people will ask me, what is good enough? And I can't make that judgment for them, but I can tell you what the good things about a project is, then the bad things are, or the less than perfect things are. Then people can make their decision based on that. And I could not have done that if I hadn't gone and understood the project myself.
How do you think CIX has performed? Have you moved the needle in the global conversation? Because there does seem to be an immensely complex global situation right now. Institutional bodies and activities and priorities are all over the place. We saw in Dubai the mechanism for central trading of offsets and stuff like that failed to come through. There doesn't seem to be a consensus here. Is Singapore making a difference? Are we making progress in any context?
So you asked two questions here. Do I think we have made a difference and have Singapore made a difference? And they're obviously two different things. So I like to equate them. I believe we've made a difference. Do I believe that we can change the world as CIX alone? No. But do I think we need more platforms like us who take a stand? Yes. And I think is when I see how people respond to our service offering, I can see that they can differentiate that from a platform where you can just buy anything you want to. So from changing the mindset of having intermediaries have a view, I think we've done a little bit. Now, Singapore, I think, has done a lot. First of all, they set themselves out to try to create a carbon service hub, and that is hard. Anybody who tries to think of a hub will know that, you know, it requires patience, it requires a good deal of luck, and a lot of bringing people together. The other day, I was trying to give an analogy to saying to, it's like building a street party, you know, the street parties that you may have done. Like, you bring all the right people there, you serve them the food, you have a lucky draw. They all come, they eat your food, they stay for the lucky draw, then they all leave and go on social media and complain about it afterwards, right? It's sometimes a little bit ungrateful to do, but Singapore has tried to do it and they've been successful elsewhere before, and I think they can beat it in this world. What have they done? So first of all, they have brought, there's more than just us here, right? We have investment companies like GenZero here. We have rating companies here. We have banks here that gets involved in the carbon market. We have traders here now that have their hub here in Singapore as well. We have strong, dedicated lawyers who understand this stuff. We have many parts of the ecosystem. And I would argue that compared to where we were 2 years ago, if I were to start a new company, I would only think about doing it in Singapore because talent base is there, or in London, right? Maybe New York, some people will say. But that's no small achievement, but it takes patience. The second thing, and perhaps the thing we all talk more about than anything, is this using carbon credit in lieu of paying your carbon tax. That, I think, was innovative and really the blueprint for other companies. And can I explain what it does? Or?
Yes, please do, because I think for people outside of Singapore, they won't necessarily understand exactly that nuance.
Yeah, so of course, there are many mechanisms for how to try and achieve net zero and climate change, right? So we know of compliance schemes where you says you can only emit this much, and if you emit more, you get a penalty or you have to buy a carbon right to emit more. So we knew the EU calls that the EU ETS, but they exist in many places. We in the carbon market call that the compliance market. So it's trying to drive down emissions by making it expensive to emit, right? Very sensible, a very good tool. The voluntary carbon market works from the other end. It works from the bottom up, you can think about it. It's saying, well, rather than only focusing on reducing emissions, let's try and think about way to preserve the emissions that we have in the ground or suck it out of the air, essentially taking carbon sequestration. And either you do that with technology, in which case carbon credits help to make them viable, or you do that by preserving the sinks that are already there. Okay. So what Singapore has done is they say, why don't we bring these two mechanisms together? We already have a Singapore tax, but instead of paying that tax, perhaps for a portion of it, 5% in our case, you can also take carbon credits and surrender them. What that does is it creates a demand for carbon credits, because if you can buy the carbon credits for $20 and the carbon tax is $25, you can make money out of that. But what is so unique about the Singaporean system is it allows credits from other countries to come in. And that's what we really need. We need a global carbon market. Now, why would Singapore do some of these things? Well, you can speculate. You could, of course, say it's because we want to foster a carbon market here in Singapore. But it's also because Singapore, by definition, is limited in its options to take climate actions. Because we're a relatively small island, we struggle to have wind and solar to the full extent. We have a grid that is partially dependent on where we can get energy from. And there are limited options to get to zero. Mm-hmm. So by doing this, they have chosen a route where credits from other countries, which has a certain characteristic called a corresponding adjustment, is also valid for their own national contribution targets. So in a sense, they created a mechanism where they says, okay, we have two choices. We give up, or we go and ask partners in other countries, please help us and we'll pay you for it, right? And Singapore has been very conscientious about this because what they said is, let's make sure that the quality of these credits is high. So they set up a framework. And that certainly moves the needle when a government says, this is what we think is quality. But they've done something else. They've also said, let's make sure that by buying these credits from another country, we don't lower the ambition or make it harder for that other country to achieve its own NDCs, natural determined contribution. Because the last thing you want to happen is Singapore looks good and it makes its, meets its goal, but then a country in Africa somewhere that they buy them from has no choice, they can't meet their own, right? So, and they've been very conscientious about it. So if you ask me, have Singapore moved the needle? The answer is a clear yes for me.
I wondered about another innovative product, which would be biodiversity credits. Now, I know that you're hugely interested in nature and wildlife in particular. And I can remember many years ago when I worked for a corporate, I actually wanted to invest in, well, this was the oceans, in coral reefs and mangroves, not just for the carbon credit, but because of the biodiversity that was related to that. So working in the seafood industry, if you don't have the nursery grounds for fish, then you actually won't have any of the large fish. Do you think that we will evolve to a stage that we have biodiversity credits? You know, there'll be market recognition for nature in that sense?
Well, first of all, a secret between you and me, Darian, in many respects, I actually, for me, a carbon market is very good for climate change, but they are also very good mechanisms for nature. So yes, truly, truly, I also think we should support them for the nature part of it, or we call it biodiversity. This market is even more nascent. It has to come to existence for a number of reasons, but is far from there. I'm part of a working group under the World Economic Forum who is trying to do something with it. And first of all, it's technically even more challenging than climate change to address because of the location-specific nature of biodiversity. But the much, much, much bigger problem is there's no incentive to buy these things right now. So it's truly altruistic. And until we create such mechanism, it could be through TNFD, Task Force for Nature-Related Financial Disclosures, it could be through compliance schemes that we are starting to see pop up, I don't think the market will sadly take off. Now, why do we need it? Well, first of all, we can talk forever about the equally big challenge of biodiversity risk, and climate change is no bigger of an issue than actually biodiversity loss. We lose a million species. That is one reason for it in and of itself. But what people, quite few people think about is, imagine one day we do magically get to net zero. Those people who are buying carbon credits, including the nature-based ones, we're asking them to do that because they admit, right? They're not going to be the buying group for these types of things. So because they said, we already decarbonized, so why should I do this? So who's going to preserve all that conservation areas and keep the carbon in the ground? We have no mechanism for that, right? Because, and, you know, it's a problem that we pushed out, of course, like kick the can down the road. But ultimately, if we don't preserve nature for nature, but we only preserve it for its carbon value, first of all, is massively undervalued for its nature preservation value. But secondly, we're going to get to a point, sadly far too late, where we realize that those people who are paying to preserve nature today are not going to be there anymore. So who is then going to pay, right? And we need that mechanism. We shouldn't wait to 2050 to develop that. So we need that. But I want to say one word of encouragement. the compliance schemes that have come up in the UK, in Australia, yes, they all have problems because it is complicated, but it is no more complicated than it is the right thing to do. And if we had more compliance schemes like that, we would be much better chance at getting to protecting 30% by 2030, which is, of course, the audacious goal that we've all set us.
It's really troubling that so many of the discourses we have around these climate issues all the time are based on technicalities. They're based around finance. They're based around carbon. They're based around technology. Nature-related discourse is such a small part, and people's capacity to relate any of this conversation to the reality of nature is still such a small part of it, which is quite depressing. And I was quite troubled by you saying, imagine if we get to zero by some magical trick. And I was like, really? Is it so fanciful that we will ever get to net zero? I mean, that's kind of a little bit worrying.
Well, I think it's important to think of, if we just get to net zero only looking at carbon, we will have missed a trick, because it's a spectrum, whether you're looking at climate or nature. And people, we are all actually part of that spectrum.
I just want to get back to where we started, just to round the conversation off. And that's the issue of trust. I mean, we've talked a lot of technicality here and detail in the processes and stuff, but just that underlying thing of trust. And I want to talk, just get your sense of the media's role in this. The BBC Panorama program, which in the way of BBC content, they present as this balanced, investigative, socially conscious approach, was criticized by one of the companies that they covered. They took cameras into a secret meeting and didn't tell them. And then the company that was in that meeting came back and said, you've completely misrepresented what we have said. The Financial Times story on Shell, Shell's head of compliance came out afterwards and said, you've really missed the point on this. The Reuters story that I just quoted at you, you said you thought was inaccurate. So much of the media coverage now seems to be pursuing this angle of, we're all being fooled because it makes a good media story. Mm. Are the media telling the real story, and are they helping in or destroying the trust that we're trying to build up?
So I think there definitely is a positive role for media to play. So I think we have, if we hadn't had the media, we'd probably be in a worse place. But I think the media does have obligation to do their research and not publish things that hasn't been. There's two criteria they need to do. When they do a study, it's got to be science-based and peer-reviewed. It has to be a real study that has gone through the right phases in order to be published. Otherwise, you are creating headlines that are very, very hard to get rid of afterwards. So I think they need to do their scientific work if they want to claim to be scientific. And then I think they have to ask themselves the question around, are we looking for sensationalism? There is something called free and prior informed consent. That means you go out to the communities impacted in a project and you ask them, are you happy with this project? Imagine you and I had to undertake one of these projects. We went out to a community of 1,000 people.
Yeah.
Do you think you get all 1,000 people to be happy? You never would, right? It's like at an AGM, you never get 100% people voting. So if you are looking for that one or two people who, of course, weren't happy in that process, you'll always find somebody who will say something negative. But if you want to do a balanced story, you also got to ask the people who did vote in favor from this, who actually were positively benefited. But we spend too much time, the media looking for the bad apple, and the project developer pointing to the good apples, rather than trying to say, look, there has been these things. We knew some of them. In some cases, they didn't. I mean, this is why I said the media does have a role in uncovering some of these things. But it's got to meet the test of, if you call yourself science-based, please be science-based. Two, make sure you're not looking for sensationalism for the sake of it. And maybe a number three, please do ask those people who are you're criticizing what their comments are. I think that's pretty much common practice in journalism, that you should be asking the people what their views of the story is, right? So I think it swung too far. But I also think we in the carbon market has not done ourselves a favor. And why do I say this? Somebody explained it to me the other day as a conundrum of a circular firing squad. apparently a circular firing squad, as you can imagine, is we all stand there with a gun in a circle and we all shoot. And yeah, we'll nobody survives, right? Hmm. And we've done that to ourselves, because if you are for supporting, I don't know, tick removals credits, or if you're in one particular standard setter, what you should be doing is you'd be standing up and supporting the other part of the carbon market and try and create trust together. But we love the circular firing squad, and I shoot at you, then tomorrow we find there's something wrong with me, you'll shoot right back, right? And you'll shoot with twice as much ammunition. And we do that to ourselves. So we self-inflict some wounds sometimes we don't really need to do, because we look very selfishly as, ha, this registry got criticized, mine looks better, or Nature Base got criticized, so mine, biochar, whatever it is, looks better. Rather than trying to say, none of us is doing ourselves a favor for the carbon market.
Mm. I heard another good analogy, which is similar, which is that we're so busy counting the leaves on the trees that we've missed that the forest is on fire.
Yeah, yeah, that's another good way to do this, right? So,
Let me just follow up on the trust thing a little bit more. There was an event of the Bezos Earth Trust not so very long ago. SBTI is funded to a large extent by the Bezos Earth Trust. And the reports out of Bloomberg that came out said that the SBTI people were coming under enormous pressure at this meeting by the corporates to relax their rules, because the corporates knew they couldn't be making that, they couldn't be making the targets under the current systems. So the question here is, the relationship between the guardians and the guarded, because it does seem that the people making the rules in a lot of this carbon market and in the broader context are the people who are also involved in the game, and the governments themselves and the independence of the enforcers is in doubt here, and the amount of power they have. Do you think that that balance is appropriate where we are?
Well, is that very different from anywhere else where people who is have a right to a voice and saying, look, you're making it too hard? I mean, I think what is important...
But it's the question here is, and you're right, is it any different from us? No, in politics we have the same thing. But the ethical question also arises. Should the people with the money and the lobbying power whose interests are being affected be the guys controlling the process?
But they're not the one who's controlling it. SBTI is not controlled by corporates. The ones who back SBTI is WWF, and I think it's VRI. It's not the corporates, right? But I think what we can require for SBTI, for ICVCM, for VERA, for all of them, is that they have a transparent consultancy process, that if somebody has a comment, they would make that a public letter or whatever it is. You know, we have these... And in there, you can make your statement. And I think I gave early on in this podcast some good reasons why corporates would say that. They're not coming and saying, we want to displace our other actions. We're simply saying is, we cannot meet those goals. If you want us to take action in the interim, we got to have more tools in the toolkit. As long as it is publicly available information that these are the companies who said that, I think it's absolutely fine that corporates can have a view, right? But I, the decision makers, as I understand the SBTI, is not the corporates.
No, but I think to your point, it's that transparency that's going to help to build trust
important.
Over time.
Correct.
That we won't hit on the perfect answer straight away, but we need to be transparent about
how
transparent. We're getting there.
Yeah, all right. Fantastic.
I ask one more cheeky question before we go? So I was reading your LinkedIn profile in preparation for today, and I noticed that your headline is that you're an animal activist. Can I ask a little bit more about that? And what are you doing on animal activism?
Well, I think since I was 17, there was really only two passions in my life. One was wildlife, and the other one was farm animal welfare. So I spend a good deal of my time outside work trying to help on both sides of this. I found myself more easily connecting to wildlife. So I both financially support, but I've also helped small project developers trying to work on conservation projects on a personal level. For that's very interesting. I'm obviously vegan. And it's probably the only thing I'm very extreme about in my life is my veganism. But I don't preach it. And then I do a lot of crazy things in terms of living with other people and trying to reduce every footprint that I can have. On the animal welfare side, I've started to get engaged as well. If you saw one of my latest blog, I use the carbon market to start to think about it. Is quite horrible sometimes how we think of animals as production machines. And since you brought it up, it's quite sad that in the context of trying to create carbon credits, you can actually make, I'm going to be very specific here, the cow eat certain things and keep them indoors, because clearly that's the best way to either reduce the methane that they emit through natural processes, or you can capture the methane. But in doing so, you're creating a lot of suffering for these animals.
Not valuing their life.
You're not valuing their life, right? Because, wow, we reduce methane, mm-hmm. and that's the number one goal. And it takes us back to your point before, Darian, about biodiversity. Let's not, in the process of solving climate change, that we certainly must be poking and focus on, make a lot of other things worse. Local communities, wildlife, and in my case, also farm animals, right? Because I know we cannot solve all 17 SDGs. You cannot solve all the world's problem in one, but we can try to not do harm for the other areas while we're solving climate change.
And I understand you're actually pursuing that aspect of your interests in your future endeavors. And I wish you luck with that, Mikhail. Thanks very much indeed for talking to us.
Thank you so much
for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.